call our third case for today, 06AP1859, Walgreen Company versus City of Madison. I'm going to read the order and time for the oral arguments to make sure we're all in agreement. Robert Hill will argue for Walgreen for 20 minutes. Mr. Wilmoth, 5 minutes for Wisconsin Merchants Federation, 15 minutes for Larry O'Brien, representing the City of Madison, 15 minutes for Mr. Hurwitz, representing the Amicus, and 5 minutes by Mr. Hill in rebuttal. Agreed? All right. Mr. Hill? We're going to... Mr. Hill is a member of the Minnesota Bar, I believe. And who is introducing you to this court? Attorney Don Millis. Mr. Millis?
May it please the court, my name is Don Millis, one of the attorneys for Walgreen Company, and I'd move the admission of Mr. Hill. In support of the motion, I would note that he is a member in good standing of the Minnesota State Bar, as the court's already indicated, and he was admitted pro hac vici by the circuit court in this matter below.
City has no objection, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Hill, you're admitted for a limited purpose for a limited time. But we're happy you're here anyway. With
Thank
full
you very
enthusiasm.
Madam Chief Justice, associate members of this honorable court, my name is Robert Hill, and I am here today representing Walgreen Company. If this court were to affirm the Court of Appeals, it would mark the first time in Wisconsin jurisprudence where the court would allow the taxation of property based solely upon one transaction containing highly favorable lease terms that are not available on the open market. We are here today because the Madison assessor chose to value a piece of paper rather than a piece of property. That piece of paper, the Walgreens lease, is being used by the assessor to artificially inflate the assessment of a store that was originally built for about $80 a square foot into an assessed value in excess of $308 a square foot.
Counsel, if you were going to buy this property, if it were for sale and you were in the second, third year of the Walgreen lease, and then right next door you had the same exact building, same property, same access, and it had no lease, which would you pay more for?
Madam Chief Justice, if Walgreens was the tenant, then I would be valuing and buying two assets, the right to get the repayment for the financing to build the store and the right to the rents from the occupant. Whereas if I was buying the store right next door and it was owner-occupied, I'd only be buying...
It's vacant.
Then I'd only be buying the store itself.
I'm buying the store too, but I'm buying it with an encumbrance, a lease. I can't use that property if Walgreen is there. Right?
Only if Walgreens remains there, Your Honor.
Sure, well, they got a 20-year lease. I think they're good for it.
And
do you?
Madam Chief Justice, the evidence in the record was undisputed that Walgreens does close stores.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but they're still liable for the rent.
And that's the key, is that contract right remains with Walgreens. Mm-hmm. So what I'd be buying in your example would be a guarantee from Walgreens that they're going to pay me, the corporate entity is going to pay me every month, and then I would go ahead and sell the store separately.
That's true of any tenant and any leasehold and any fee simple. When you buy it and it has a tenant in there, if the tenant's paying good rent, that property, and it's a good tenant, and it's a long-term lease, the property's worth more. Isn't the basic issue here, what's the fair market value of this property?
I believe the basic issue, Madam Chief Justice, was enunciated by this court in the flood case. What we have here is a highly favorable
the fair lease. Market value, is that the basic first issue?
Of the property rights, yes, Your
Honor. It's a fair market value, right? And if there had been a recent sale, we would look at that, right?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, there have been sales of Walgreens stores, and they typically sell for what other retail stores sell for in the open market, $100 a square foot. In fact, one of the things that...
Is that in evidence here?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, we had four transactions that we spoke of. We had three separate experts that talked about the fact that what happens when Walgreens decides that it wants to close a store is that it buys out the least fee interest, the contract right. In fact, we had a store in Eden Prairie, Minnesota, in testimony in the record, tears up the lease because the contract right's now been satisfied, and then sells the store on the open market at what stores similar to ours sell for.
Vacant.
Vacant and available.
That's my other example. So it's selling it at vacant, but if it sold it with the Walgreen lease, it would be fair market value,
and that's
right?
The critical, yes, Your Honor, and that's the critical distinction here is that there's a contract right over here, and there's the bundle of rights associated with the real property over there. Now, they've chosen, in this case, to call it a lease. If we called it a development agreement, if we called it a service contract, and had the exact same terms, we wouldn't be here. Reason? Because the financing arrangement would be different. It would be conventional. So what we're talking about here, and I think this is a critical point, is that when Walgreens goes to its developer and says, we want this location on Washington Avenue, and this is how much we'll pay you to build the store. If Walgreens were to instead go to a bank and say, we're going to build the store ourselves and take out a mortgage, then the value of the property would be what it costs to build it. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever pays more for a piece of property, for the bricks, the mortar, and the land, than it would cost to build a substitute property of like utility, just as Your Honor has pointed out, right across the street. Mm-hmm. So what is causing the trouble here? It's that contract right is contained in a lease instrument. It doesn't have to be, and that's why I think this court's decision in Flood is so applicable, because assessors as well as appraisers are required to look at all factors that influence value. Here, what we have is the assessor has looked at one term, the bottom line rent, to the exclusion of all other factors. And I believe, as this court held in Darcell, assessors are never free to look at the bottom line, to just simply race to the bottom line rents to the exclusion of all other factors that influence value. 2 years ago, this court in Adams Outdoor Advertising said that it's error for an assessor to disregard the sales comparison approach. In this particular case, we put forward a sales comparison approach of four retail properties in Madison, and that approach was disregarded altogether. But it is always a mistake to focus in on one factor in a lease to the exclusion of all other factors that influence value.
What factor do you focus on?
The sale of the real property itself, the fee simple interest of what the property would fetch standing alone.
Because without a lease.
Without the lease. Because the form of ownership should never dictate an assessment if what we're about is uniformity. And that's the critical distinction here is that because we choose to pay a developer as opposed to going to a bank and doing it ourselves, we're being punished.
You're paying out in periodic payments, right?
You're amortizing the cost. Yes, Your Honor.
And you're not tied up in getting a mortgage. Your capital isn't tied up. You don't show that as a liability, right?
Exactly.
So what you're really doing is buying the property over how many years?
Normally, they amortize the build-out or the development costs over 20 years, Your Honor.
Right, which is your lease.
So which is our lease, correct.
So what are you really paying for this property over 20 years?
For the property itself, yeah. We're repaying the developer roughly the cost to build it, which in this case was about $2.1 million in each case.
And how much do you think it should be assessed for?
$2.1 million. Mm-hmm. And the reason is the bricks and the mortar and the land would only sell for that. You know, Exhibit 18 is not something we put in our appendix, Your Honor, but I would ask that the court look at it during your deliberations. What we did is we submitted, over stern objections, but we submitted the assessments of all of the other retail properties in Madison. And if you look at Exhibit 18, our assessments in 2004 were at $308 and $255 a square foot. Companies such as Circuit City, Best Buy, OfficeMax, PetSmart, Office Depot, all with identical construction, all with identical location, all with identical everything when you're talking about the fee simple interest, the bundle of rights associated with the sale and purchase of property, assessed at $139, $118, $89. What is causing this distinction and this disparity? How can it be that the form of ownership of a property can increase an assessment by almost $200 a square foot? And the answer is that they're taxing the business enterprise income, the business value of Walgreens. The promise that Walgreens corporate makes to every one of these developers that regardless of whether we're a tenant in this store, regardless of whether we close the store tomorrow, you're going to get your money back with a handsome profit. That, I submit to the court, has never been the basis for real property taxation in Wisconsin. In fact, going all the way back to the IBM case in 1939, this court warned against the problem of relying exclusively on the income approach alone.
How do you distinguish the Darcel and the Metropolitan cases? As I recall those, both of those dealt with contract rents lower than the market rent. And you seem to say that's okay. My thought process is you can't have it both ways. Your argument thus far sounds to me like, well, you should be talking about contracts that differ than the market rents. It's the market's rents. It's the market rents. It's the all the different properties and what's going on in the market. And yet, you seem to say that Darcel and Metropolitan are okay as long as the market rent, as long as the contract rent is lower than the market rent.
Your Honor, Justice Bradley, you've raised a very important point about Darcel. Darcel had several holdings. First, and the primary holding of the case, was that there was a sale of the property. We don't have that here. But there are two holdings that I would commend to the court that come right from Darcel. First, that an assessor is never entitled to go to the bottom line rents or compare the bottom line rents charged in a lease. Rather, what assessors are supposed to do is consider that rent juxtaposed with the historically justified market rents at the time that the leases were entered into. And all we're saying, Justice Bradley, is that the historically, when you compare our above market rents to the historically justified market rents that were in existence in 2003 and 2004, we're paying double. And that difference is because we have to pay back the cost of building the building.
Let me, in Darcel, the court stated, the goal is to ascertain what an investor would pay for the property, and contract rents, not market rents, are the clearest indicator of what the investor would pay. How do you, in that case anyway, how do you deal with that language?
Well, in our case, the property itself, vacant and available, would only sell for what other vacant and available 15,000 square foot retail drugstores sell for in the market. The assumption that's underlying this entire proceeding is that because Walgreens is creditworthy, because they have the financial ability, at least right now, to pay, therefore that runs with the land and therefore we should be able to tax it as though it's real estate. I would submit, Justice Bradley, that if tomorrow Walgreens quit paying the rent, would it be the rule of law of this court that the properties would then be worthless? In IBM, this court warned that the reason you don't just fixate on one factor to the exclusion of all other factors that influence value is that that would mean that non-income producing property is worthless. That's a quote from the 1939 IBM case. Here, what we're doing is talking about Walgreens' creditworthiness. And the evidence was undisputed at trial Your Honor, that they do separate out the contract rights. In fact, we had an appraiser come in, Tim Vergeen, and talked about how when investors go to buy the assets, they value the contract right, and then separately they value the fee simple interest or the real property. You did not have that in Darcel. The reason that Darcel was decided the way it was, in my view, has nothing to do with you can't have it both ways. It has to do with the fact that the sale price of the property was influenced by the below market leases. That the owner, no matter who owned it, was not going to be able to get market rents. We have just the polar opposite of that in our case. Whoever owns this property can rent it at whatever the market rents are that exist on that boulevard in Madison at the time. That's not disputed. But the question then becomes, what if Walgreens decides not to be there? Or what if, like Eckert Drug, their business plan fails for whatever reason?
Your appraisal value will go down next year.
And what we would then be doing, Your Honor, and this is why I believe the flood case is so powerful, is we would start to be, we'd have an inherently unequal assessment where profitable leases would be treated one way and everybody else would be treated another way. And I believe that the manual, that's why this court has been real strong. Adams Outdoor Advertising, this court says that taxing business value should be the exception, not the norm. If we start taxing profitable leases, then what we're going to do is segregate out and say, you know what, if you've got a profitable business plan, if you're Walgreens and you can make it work, then we're going to assess you differently than everybody else who just simply goes out into the marketplace and leases property. The one thing about this case that's critical to understand is that after we get the bill from the developer, $2.1 million in this case, then we do negotiate market rents, same as everybody else. So we've never asked the lower courts or the assessor to disregard the market rents. We just want to be treated the same as everybody else because assessment is about equality. It's about sharing the burden. In fact, I believe, to quote this court, the goal of an assessor is to treat equally equity between and among individual taxpayers.
Counselor, I want you to shift gears for me just a little bit. There was one issue in the briefs about whether Walgreens had presented enough evidence at the circuit court level to maintain its objection to the 2004 assessment. Could you address that, please?
Yes, Justice Rogensack. By way of background, we appeared with our appraiser at the 2003 and presented a full-blown appraisal. We then, the assessments were sustained on both count or on both stores. And then in 2000, and then we filed a refund suit. So when we got to the Board of Review in 2004, we brought the manager from one of the Walgreens and gave a written opinion of value, but nothing had changed. The market rents had remained the same. The sales we were relying upon remained the same. All things remained the same. The Board of Review conducted its hearing. They waived any objection to the quantity or quality of the evidence because we didn't take ours in the second case as we had in the first, and they sustained the assessments. It was only at the circuit court where they resurrected the issue for the first time and said, we're not satisfied that they made a sufficient showing at the Board of Review, so we believe the circuit court should bar them from proceeding in this court on the 2004. And as this court knows, the circuit court did do that. But we believe the fee case is controlling on that. When there's a waiver, an express waiver by the Board of Review, they can't then turn around and say, well, now we've changed our minds, and now we don't think your evidence was sufficient. So first of all, we did present a written opinion of value, which we think under the statute qualifies in and of itself. But beyond that, there was an express waiver.
When you say an express waiver, you mean because they didn't object at the Board of Review saying the evidence was insufficient?
Correct, which is why we think we're on all fours with the fee case.
Thank you.
Mr. Hill, I'd like to ask you, your opposing counsel on page 9 of his brief, quotes from the appraisal of real estate 12th edition. a leased property, even one with rent that is consistent with market rents, is appraised as a leased fee interest, not as a fee simple interest. It seems to me your argument, basically, as I read it, if I understand it, is that you think this should be appraised as a fee simple interest. Explain this quote and why this doesn't decide the case.
Yes, Justice Prosser. In fact, if you go to the next paragraph that they didn't quote, say that anytime you have a landlord-tenant situation, you have to look at the leases, the leased fee. And then they go on to say, but if what you're trying to determine is the market value of the property, then the appraiser must examine the fee simple interest, must do an appraisal of what the property standing alone would sell for in the marketplace. What they're talking about when they in this particular paragraph of the appraisal of real estate is that anytime you have a leased fee situation, in other words, you've got an owner of real estate that's leasing it out to somebody else, you try to determine what portion of that rent, if any, is above market. In fact, at Supplemental Appendix 4, we actually give you the page. They selectively took the first half of that without giving you the back half, and I would suggest that if you read the back half, all it says, Justice Prosser, is that the fee simple estate is what any appraiser would value if what you're trying to determine is what the property standing alone, the bundle of rights standing alone.
When you say the back half.
The next paragraph of that very quote.
Okay. Is this in this appendix here?
I believe so.
Of your reply brief?
Yes, Your Honor. Supplemental page S2.
S2?
S2, yep. Supplemental appendix page 2.
Why don't you? Okay. The quote from your opposing counsel is on S1.
Mm-hmm.
I want you to read the quote from S2 that you find so.
Okay. The value, so on S1, just to continue, even if the rent or the lease terms are not consistent with market terms, the lease fee interest must be given special consideration and is appraised as a lease fee interest. The valuation of a lease fee interest is best accomplished using the income capitalization. Regardless of the capitalization method selected, the value of the lease fee interest represents the owner's interest in the property. The benefits that accrue to an owner of a lease fee interest generally consist of income throughout the lease. The sales comparison approach can be used to value lease fee interest, but this analysis is only meaningful when the sales being used are comparables of similar lease fee. And then if you go to the next full paragraph, Your Honor, I'll just drop down. When an assignment involves the valuation of a leased fee interest, the appraiser often must also appraise the fee simple interest. If the rent and or terms or lease are favorable to the landlord, and that's what we have here, the value of the lease fee interest will usually be greater than the value of the fee simple interest, resulting in a negative leasehold. That's the critical fact in this case. Walgreens is being punished in its assessment simply because it's chosen a form of ownership where the developer pays the upfront costs of acquiring the site, relocating a business, constructing a new store, and putting Walgreens in there. And we choose, because we can afford it, to pay that developer back in what we call an amortized lease.
But
professional appraisal practice does not allow any appraiser, or for that matter, any assessor, to simply look at the leased fee enhancement and call it a real property right, because it remains with the owner of that paper. Again, if Walgreens takes down its sign and moves out of that store tomorrow, and I own the paper, I don't really care if they're there or not, because I can go ahead and sell the store to somebody else, and that would be its assessed value, presumably. But I would also get that money from Walgreens corporate over the next 20 years. That's why the rights are severable in this case. And that's why, regardless of how we slice it, it remains a contract right that's separate and apart from the value of the real estate itself.
Now, what about the next paragraph that says, that goes on to say that you have to look at everything. Then it says, when analyzing a leased fee interest, is that what we're doing here?
Yes, we are, Your Honor.
All right. It is essential that the appraiser analyze all the economic benefits or disadvantages created by the lease. An appraiser should ask the following questions. One, what's the term of the lease? 20 years?
Yes.
What is the likelihood that the tenant will be able to meet all the rental payments on time?
We don't know that. That's the critical thing.
Well, you never know that in anybody. I mean, life is like that.
It's true, and that's why I believe this Court's been real firm in saying that's why you don't...
You disagree with that. You disagree with that as an attribute or a question to be asked, because your answer has to be, we don't know.
No, my answer is that, of course, you consider that.
Okay. Are the various clauses and stipulations in the lease typical of the market, or do they create special advantages or disadvantages for either party?
And that's where I think
this
there's
typical,
the rub.
It's typical in Walgreens.
It's so atypical that's the whole point, is we're being okay. Singled out.
No other company does business this way.
Not according to Exhibit 18, because if they did, our assessments wouldn't be $200 a square foot higher than everybody else.
Is either the leased fee interest or the leasehold interest transferable, or does the lease prohibit transfer?
And in this case, the obligation to make that repayment is personal to Walgreens.
Owner of the land can transfer the land.
They could transfer it, but...
The lease isn't expired or terminated.
It's not. And if I was buying that paper, the one provision in these leases that make ours completely atypical is I want to make sure that Walgreens is going to pay me. I don't want any free assignment of the lease from the tenant's point because I don't trust
anybody.
What does
the lease say? Is it an assignable lease?
Nope. And that's the whole point. That obligation to make that repayment is personal to Walgreens.
Okay.
The reason that the contract right is valuable is because I'm banking on the fact that Walgreens is going to continue in business.
Most of the leases I drafted said the tenant can't transfer the lease because I was relying on that tenant. So that's not atypical in leases.
The part that I'm referring to, Your Honor, is the obligation to make the repayment of the development cost.
Okay. Is the lease written in a manner that will accommodate reasonable change over time? So after 20 years, what does it become? A 5-year optional renewable?
What happens at the end of that is that they renegotiate the lease terms based on fee simple principles.
Okay. So all of that is taken into account. You don't object to that?
Not at all, Your Honor. I think our case comes down to the box that's right at the bottom of the page in the left-hand corner.
Yep, negative leasehold and positive leasehold. Okay.
Yeah, which is fancy ways of saying that that leased fee interest is the value of the contract right that's embedded in this real estate lease. In Darcell, what this court faced, and in Metropolitan, and in West Bend, in the Court of Appeals case, the contract rents were below. But the goal of assessment is to get to that market rent. And the reason for that is simple. As this court has stated time and time again, the assessors are not free to look at business income in one case and ignore it in all other cases. And that's what's happened here, is that our leases are being looked at as though they're different.
I wonder if you could explain that chart to me.
Sure.
I understand it as to what negative leasehold means, what positive leasehold means, what's the contract rent. What does that tell me about fair market value for assessment?
It means that what assessors, and this is where the Wisconsin manual and the statutes are clear, the assessor's goal is to get back to that dotted line, the market rents. And the reason is that you're supposed to compare the comparability of two properties. You're not supposed to treat one property or an assessment in a vacuum and say that, well, because you have the business acumen, that you can pay the excess as opposed to going to a bank, that you should pay more on your real estate. Now, if we want to...
Well, is that what Darcell held? I didn't think that's what Darcell held. I think Darcel is not in conformity to that.
Darcel would be on the right hand.
I understand that.
Yeah. And
it doesn't come up to market rent.
Right. And what this court held, and it did so with, a pretty intense analysis, is when you have contract rents that fall below the market rents, mm-hmm. we're going to first of all look at were they historically justified market rents at the time the leases were entered into. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to look at, okay, did they influence the sale of the property itself in the sense of how much that the buyer was willing to pay and how much the seller was able to get? And the answer in that case is yes. But in our case, if the property were severed and sold, it would only sell for a price equivalent to where the market rents are. For the same reason as any other retailer, nobody pays more for a piece of property than it costs to build a similar property across the street. And that's basically what we have here, is a situation where the principle of substitution in our case, unlike Darcel, is violated by the fact that they want to tax our contract and not simply our real estate. I see my time is up, Your
yes,
Honor.
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Hill.
Justice Prosser.
You attempted to distinguish the Darcel case by the fact that there was a sale of the property. Is that right?
Your Honor, we believe that Darcel, we are trying to focus in on the holdings in Darcel that we believe are applicable. There was a sale of the property in Darcel that we don't have, which that fact is distinguishable, but the holdings that we think are applicable in Darcel are the fact that assessors shouldn't just fixate on one.
Let me ask this question.
Yes, Your Honor.
I understand there has not been any sale of the property at 2909 East Washington, but it seems to me there were some sales of the property at 3710 East Washington, and they seem, those sales at the level that they were at, seem to correspond with the city's theory. Why are we not considering the sale of that property, at least for that property?
It's a very good question, Your Honor. I can answer it this way. Not even the assessor.
I'm sorry, the what?
That's a very good question, Your Honor, and I can answer it this way. Not even the assessor treated it as a sale of the real estate standing alone. The testimony at trial was that they couldn't find a comparable sale.
But why do you have to have a comparable sale if you're selling the property?
Because I can only speak, they're the ones that didn't even bring it into evidence, but there were two rights that were sold in that transaction, the contract right to get reimbursed for the development of the store, and then, of course, the fee simple interest in the store itself. There was no sale of the real estate standing alone. All I know for certain, Justice Prosser, is that the assessor herself rejected it, didn't even bring it up as a fact in their favor. And I don't think that was oversight, because, again, what we're talking about is uniformity, and property needs to be valued based on what it sells for standing alone, not what a contract right attached to the property adds. Because, again, if Walgreens closes the store tomorrow and that for sale sign goes up on that property, Your Honor, it will only sell for what property of similar character and kind in that location would sell for. And I find that as troubling as the court, because it's like, why did they not...
How recent was it? I'm sorry.
It was a recent sale. This paper transfers all the time. There's a secondary market. They call them corporate bonds. They call them coupon bonds.
Could I ask one other question? There is somewhere in here figures about the net profit, I think, from which you calculate a capitalization rate or something like that.
Yes, Your Honor.
And there have to be sort of gross sales, and then you subtract from that something to get to a net profit. But where, I don't see where the payment of property taxes fits into that.
These are triple net leases, so Walgreens is responsible for the payment of the taxes. One thing that I know for certain, Your Honor, is that if the owner of this paper was responsible for the taxes, they wouldn't be calling this a lease. They'd be calling it what it really is, a development agreement. And the reason for that is that's a business transaction that's a severable right. In fact, if you go to our rent analyses, what we do is before we start talking about the actual rents we pay, we first have to figure out how are we going to amortize this build-out cost. How many years is it going to take us, and at what rate do we have to pay? All of that is atypical. None of that is open market. None of that is subject to any kind of arm's-length negotiation. We simply tell them we want this site at this location, go build it for us, and we guarantee you that we will repay you at the completion of the turnkey. In fact, if you look in the evidence, you'll see one of our rent analyses says turnkey. These developers work exclusively for us, and we aren't known to pay more than the market will bear for locations and for super adequacies such as high ceilings and fiber optics, all of which are embedded in that lease instrument, none of which bear any relation to what the property would rent for or sell for on the open market. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Wilmoth?
Oh, I'm sorry. But you're going to go at the end.
Representing Wisconsin Merchants Federation, Inc.
May it please the court, my name is David Wilmoth, and I'm here today as a friend of the court representing the Wisconsin Merchants Federation. The Wisconsin Merchants Federation has more than 400 members with over 1,000 retail locations within the state of Wisconsin. For more than 80 years, the Federation has been representing the interests of retailers within the state with the objective of promoting a business climate which allows retailers the opportunity to operate as efficiently and economically as possible for the benefit of retailers, consumers, and the state's economy. In its brief in this matter, the City of Madison says that there is no need for this court to engage in speculation about what it might mean to other property taxpayers if the court affirms the decision of the Court of Appeals. Its contention is that this case is just about two parcels of land in the City of Madison on which Walgreens conducts retail operations. But the case is about much more than that. The decision of the Court of Appeals affects a fundamental change in the method of valuing leased property in the state. Never has this court considered the issue of whether an appraiser may, in valuing real property for property tax purposes, rely solely on an income approach which simply capitalizes rental payments, which are indisputably far in excess of market rent. The Federation and its members are deeply concerned about the potential far-reaching implications of the court's decision in this case. Many of the Federation's members operate out of lease facilities under triple net leases, which require them to bear the cost of the property taxes imposed on the premises. While none of the Federation's members may have a business model identical to Walgreens, many retailers, large and small, enter into leases that have elements of other business or financial arrangements embodied in them. These leases may, and often do, have rental payments which are in excess of market rents.
These are built to suit. That is, the builder builds or rebuilds to suit the tenant, right?
Sometimes. You know, a good example is some fast food franchisers, McDonald's is a good example, own restaurants and lease them to their franchisees. And they employ a business model which often folds various charges, either for services or development costs, into the lease. Or often they'll base the rental payments, at least in part, on a percentage of sales made at the location. And the result of these arrangements is typically above market rents. But the premium paid by the franchisee has nothing to do with anything inherent in the underlying property, and instead it reflects a financial dealing between the parties, and certainly in the case of rental payments measured by sales, it includes the business value of the franchisee's operation at that particular location.
Mr. Wilmoth, if the developer that owns, let's say, either one of these Walgreens sites, just simply sold the property today, they would also be selling the lease rights and sort of guaranteed rent of, in one case, $430,000 a year, I think it is. Why should that be treated differently from the rule in Darcel? I mean, well, if you can take into account contract leases when they're below market rents, why can you not do that when it's above market rents?
Well, Justice Prosser, I think our answer to that is in the Darcel case, the court looked at a situation where you had a mall that at the time they leased the properties in that mall, they were fair market leases, and over the course of time, they became below fair market value leases. And when they went to sell the property, it sold for a price under what it would otherwise have sold for if they had market leases in place, and the court determined that that was an encumbrance on the property that was inherited by the purchaser. And I think that that's an encumbrance that's going to be there regardless of who the tenants are. If one of the tenants fails, if their business fails, if they're not creditworthy, that's actually an advantage to the buyer as opposed to a disadvantage. I mean, that's an encumbrance on the property. It limits the ability of the purchaser going forward to rent that at fair market value rents. Conversely, where you've got a situation where you've got above market rents, it's necessarily going to require assessors to evaluate the creditworthiness, the business model, the ability over time of that lessee to pay. I mean, in the instance of Walgreens, they're a large public company, which people typically think of as having a significant financial ability. But if you know, I guess the question is, why should somebody be paying? Well, obviously, the Walgreens property might sell for more because of the guarantee of the payments over time. But if you have, you know, the Dave Wilmoth McDonald's franchise, even though I may be paying above market rents for that, somebody's going to evaluate my net worth and my creditworthiness and not likely, you know, add very much to the market rent value for that. And in that instance, you're really taxing, you're valuing properties based on the business of the tenant, not on the value of the underlying property. I mean, you're evaluating the viability of the business going forward and making a judgment as to whether you're going to get those above market rents over time.
Well, here's what's bothering me. If I listened carefully and I tried, and if I understood Mr. Hill correctly, he wants this store just valued on bricks and mortar, just what it costs to build it or what it costs to rebuild it, and that's its fair market value. He has nothing in there for the lease. Below market or above market. It costs $2 million to build. That should be assessed value. Empty, below market rent, above market rent. That doesn't make sense to me. I don't think you'd assess a shopping mall the same if all the stores were empty as if you would that all the stores had fair market leases, or all the stores had above fair market leases, or below fair market value leases. You'd assess that property differently, wouldn't you?
I think you take into account a variety of factors, I think including lease rates.
Sure. So the lease somehow has to be accounted for in this assessment, right? So how do you differentiate between the fair market lease payment and these other costs that are put in, as in McDonald's or as in Walgreens? Don't you have to separate those two if we take your theory?
Yes.
Right. So how what evidence, maybe you can't answer it, but maybe Ms. Dale can when he comes back, what evidence was presented as to what the fair market rent was?
I don't know that.
Okay. But that's a fair question.
It is. I mean, and historically, you know, appraisers have valued leased properties,
sure,
taking into account market rents. I mean, they have that information available to them.
Yeah, otherwise, that chart doesn't make any sense on page 82. I mean, so somebody's figured out market rent. I mean, we can disagree about it, but it's figured out. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Now, Mr. O'Brien. Larry O'Brien representing the City of Madison.
Still don't sit so well, Your Honor. I have my own timer, by the way. I'm Larry O'Brien. I'm an assistant city attorney. I've been involved in this case since inception. I have a prepared outline, but with the court's permission, I'd like to address a couple of things that Mr. Hill and Mr. Wilmot have said. First, this court very recently indicated that what is to be assessed is what exists on the lien date, Jan 1 of any given tax date, not what might occur down the road, not what had occurred before. What counts is what happens and what existed on January 1 of each of these tax years. Secondly,
was that wrong?
I'm sorry?
Is that wrong?
No, no, certainly not.
Thank you, sir.
Self-serving.
Another fact. Walgreens is there on January 1 of each of these tax years. They had a lease which existed on each of those tax days. There's no evidence to suggest that Walgreens is not the financial giant that it apparently is with some, what, 7,000 stores?
I think the argument really is...
I'm sorry?
I think the argument really is, what if these were Pat Rogensack drugstores instead of Walgreens drugstores, and I had the same lease. I had hired somebody to develop this property for me, because I sure don't have millions, I can tell you, to develop a property. And so now you got a Pat Rogensack drugstore, same lease terms exactly.
Same lease terms?
Exactly the same lease terms. I didn't have any money to put into this, so I let those guys finance it for me and build the store, and I'm paying them over 20 years for
the answer
development.
Would be exactly the same. We would base it on the lease rate, and I'll tell you why.
Okay, that was my next question, so go ahead.
Why? Mm-hmm. Because what counts is what the subsequent owner can get, and the subsequent buyer of the lease is what is being bought and sold. And that is going to be dependent on the lease fee value, which is the assessor's value. And the reason that I say that exists exactly in the record. At page 3 of my brief, everything runs with the land, so to speak, for 60 years. That is Mr. Murphy for Walgreens. Absolutely every right and obligation to Walgreens and from Walgreens that the prior owner had, right? Yes. Mr. Vitale, the appraiser for Walgreens, when East Green, that's the 3710 property, sells, assuming that it does, we know that it did, I'll get into that in a moment, during the term of the lease, what will they sell? Contracted a bit, the leased fee interest. And that property would not be your valuation of the property, that would be the leased fee value, correct? Correct.
But, Counselor, isn't the lease fee value dependent upon whether Pat Rogensack can really pay these payments for 20 years?
No. It depends on what the subsequent buyer can get. And if your subsequent buyer can get the leased fee value, which it does,
I think we're not on the same page.
That's entirely possible.
Just pretend I'm Walgreens.
Okay.
And I'm going to make these payments to the developer, okay? And somebody's going to buy from the developer this contract with me to make these payments. You think they're going to pay as much for that contract right as they would if Walgreens was making the payments? That was my question.
I think you're getting at the ability to pay.
And I thought you were getting at it by saying how strong Walgreens was and what a mega corporation they were.
See, that's one of the failings, I think, in Mr. Hill's argument in Walgreens, because they're saying... we are only looked at one factor. But in your situation, we could very easily consider all the factors as we were supposed to do and which we have done. So if your ability to pay was one of those factors that decreased the ability of the investor to get the lease fee value, if that happens, the assessor can deal with it.
But the ability of the person who has the lease fee's ability to keep paying is not what the assessor is valuing. The assessor is valuing the real estate.
It's one of the factors. Just one of the factors. That's what Mr. Hill and Walgreens is arguing. We consider it when it occurs. We don't know what your situation would be on January 1 of any given tax year. When we found out, we would deal with it and assess it accordingly.
Okay. Well, I guess my concern was with selling the obligation, my obligation, to continue to make payments, and what would that sell for? And unless, I must have misunderstood you, because I thought that you said you don't have to worry about Walgreens continuing to pay. And so I wanted to put myself in the position, who does not have the ability to pay that Walgreens does.
Perfectly reasonable.
Would you be selling it? And so now you're telling me, well, yeah, you might value it for less if I were the person that had to make the payments, but that's just one factor that you would consider.
Correct.
Okay, I understand better. Thank you very
okay.
much. You cleared it up for me.
There's another interesting thing that Mr. Murphy said. And that relates to the 3710 property. That quote appears on page 7. Do you think he'd probably get it for the 2 mil price? The value that Mr. Hill said was the value that they were going to say as valuation for assessment purposes? Answer, probably not. You're not going to get it for what they're saying because they're selling the lease. 3710 sold for $540,000 more than the assessed value. And why? Because they bought the leased fee, the amount of the guaranteed rent for a minimum of 20 years.
Council, may I ask, if they were to restructure things and have a lease agreement that provided for rent at $10 a square foot and a development agreement that provided for $20 a square foot to repay development fees, if they were able to assess out what they were willing to lease for and what they wanted to pay back over 20 years for development, you know, what it took to make the property what it is to fit their needs, would you still just tax the lease?
First off, that isn't the fact of the record. Secondly, if it were the fact in the next case, we will deal with it. Third, if indeed the development contract is something other than what they're saying it is now, lease, rent, all I'm saying is that everything depends on what the facts are and who the owner is and what the lease terms are and all the rest of it as of the lien date. We can speculate forever.
Well, was there evidence in the record of what the real transaction was, that this was really not rent? It was repayment of development fees? Was that in the record?
There was a dispute as to what it was.
I asked. There may be a dispute, but did they bring in an expert who testified as to how this is done and how the fees are set up and whether they're doing this, they're viewing it as rent for one purpose, like income tax, corporate tax, or they're viewing it as a different thing for assessment?
No. There was no evidence as terms of the tax implications. There was substantial evidence in the record concerning how the parties, Walgreen and the developer, acted.
Reached this amount.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Are they the only ones in the country that have these kinds of arrangements?
Oh, I couldn't possibly answer that.
What about in Madison?
As far as we know, Walgreens is the only one. I could stand corrected, but there's nothing in the record to show that there are others.
What do you do with everybody else? Do you? You have a store that's rented, and it's above market rent. How do you assess that property? Must be other instances in Madison.
You would assess that on the income approach or the cost approach, depending on the facts of the particular case, Justice.
Both are acceptable.
Yes.
Maybe look at both of them and see where you get.
We don't artificially jack up prices, Chief Justice.
I'm not suggesting you did. I just want to have several different approaches. Cost may give you one number. Income capitalization may give you another. Rebuilding may give you a third. I mean, they're just fair market value of comparable sales may give you a fourth.
Okay, that does raise the next point, I think. And if I hope I will stay on the same page with you. The assessor looked at the cost approach, decided that it wasn't reliable. Walgreens' witnesses also looked at the cost approach and indicated that the cost approach is not buyers and sellers of real property, retail properties, I'll get it, rarely utilize the cost approach for valuing existing properties.
When you talk about cost approach, the cost to build this, cost to build a comparable
right.
store.
And as we saw from the 3710 sale, they don't base it on the cost approach, they base it on what they based it on, the lease fee value. Secondly, the appraiser looked at comparable sales, determined, as did the court of the circuit court, that there were no comparable sales. In other words, sales of comparable properties, part of which was because they don't have the same kinds of lease arrangements and a variety of other kinds of things. So Mr. Vitale also did not accord significant consideration to the comparable sales approach. So that leaves us with the income approach. And this court, in Adams at paragraph 53, flatly agreed with the manual that indicated that the assessor may disregard matters which do not bear on the value of the property. In this particular case, even Walgreens witnesses said neither cost nor comparable sales applied. And it's right there in the record. And if you're looking at it, because I see Mr. Hill nodding no, according significant consideration is at the Vitale report for 3710 at page 53, both quotes.
Okay, may I ask you this? If you have similar or identical buildings, but you have on one of these buildings these extraordinary above market rents, and it is, in your view, proper to value the building taking into account that rent, aren't you really taking advantage of a business decision in some way? And do you think that Walgreens is just going to sit back and take that?
Obviously not. That's why we're here. The fact of the matter is that the leases are going to be examined. Maybe I'm missing your question here. Can you restate it for me, please?
It seems to me you acknowledge that the rents are far above market value. Contract rents are far above market value.
I'm back with you.
And isn't there something sort of fundamentally unfair about taxing property?
It is the logical extension of Darcell. If the
life
taxpayer
the law is
can
not logic, it is experience.
Well, hopefully a little logic.
Would you prefer converse? If indeed the taxpayer can reap the benefit of avoiding taxes under a below-market lease, which is Darcell, why is there a problem with the balance of the taxpayers achieving what the fair market value of the property, i.e. the taxes, would be on the higher than market rent? And it isn't the question of the necessarily of the market rent, because Darcell said the market rent below or at rate was immaterial. It isn't the question of what the market rate might be. It's a question of whether or not the subsequent buyer is going to be able to buy. In Darcell, it was hampered by the below market lease because that was all the seller could sell. In this particular case, the seller, and it's agreed without dispute at all, that the subsequent buyer, number one, is going to pay the lease fee value, which is the assessor's value, and will not get it for the fee simple value, which is Walgreens' appraised price. So you're valuing the lease, what the person can buy and sell.
I'm going to ask Justice Process's question slightly differently. If this sum paid, which city labels it as a lease, is really an artificially increased lease price caused by unusual financing arrangement between the buyer and the seller, or here between the tenant and the landlord, That's what their argument is, that it's not rental income and it's not a rental payment. It's an artificial number that shows an unusual financing arrangement. And under Flood and Flint, they were sales, not landlord-tenant. But under Flood and Flint, since it's artificial, it's not really rent but financial agreement, you should figure out what is a fair market rent for this property.
If you approach it from that direction, the value of the lease is essentially exempt. And the statutes require that all value must be taxed, and that's what
they're essentially exempt. I mean, I don't agree with Mr. Hill that you just look at brick and mortar.
Yes.
I mean, that's just a building. That's, he wants it valued as an empty place. It's not empty.
Correct.
You want it valued as an ongoing lease, but you don't want to look at this lease and see, is it really a lease or is it something else?
All I'm saying, and I'm starting to repeat myself, so maybe I'm missing your question or
no,
your point.
That's why you only took 15 minutes, but that's okay. What's the response? What's the response to my question?
The simple fact is that what is being bought and sold is the lease value, and that's the converse of Darcel.
You're not going to take into consideration the financial aspects of this, if there were such.
If there were such, there's no evidence that there, in fact, there was. But
so
other
you're
than
saying there's
said,
no evidence in the record that there was part of the financial transaction.
If indeed it comes up, we'll deal with it at that time.
Thank you,
Mr. O'Brien.
Sorry, Justice Prosser.
Is the valuation of this property going to be frozen for 20 years?
That would conceivably be the case, although if indeed it's sold, we might know a different value of the sale price. Down the road, it may be that for one reason or another, Walgreens wants out. There may be a difficult sale because somebody else doesn't like the building, and the owners might negotiate something different other than the total value of the lease fee. Because that's why I keep emphasizing. We're talking about what might occur, and I'm talking about what is, in fact, on the lien date. The rest of it's speculation. The rest of it is very interesting, and the rest of it's a wonderful academic exercise, but we'll deal with it when the time comes.
So if January 1, next year, Walgreens went bankrupt, and it wasn't going to pay its lease, it went out of business, would the assessed value go down if no one else was in there?
Depends on all the facts. It may.
I give you all the facts. It's now empty. Walgreens is kaput. You're not going to get anything in the bankruptcy court on this lease.
We'd examine the facts. If those facts were, as you say, the assessment could go down.
Promise? Okay, counsel, thank you. Mr. Horowitz, you have 15 minutes representing several groups, and I will just say municipalities, if that's all right with you.
Let me address some of the questions raised by the justices this afternoon. First, what about the fact that the contract rents are above market rents because that's the way that Walgreens negotiated the deal? And the answer is, that doesn't make any difference because the buyer is going to buy the owner's interest in the property based on the contract rent, regardless of whether the contract rent was negotiated to be above market rent. It's the same as if a lease were entered into at market rent and then market rents went down and the contract rent became above market rent. The buyer would be interested in what the contract rents are. So how it's the motivations of Walgreens are not relevant. That's why the Flood case and the fee case are irrelevant, because the questions there were whether the sale of the property or the sale of comparable property was an arm's length sale. And that was the reason and the only reason why the court was interested in whether there were unusual financing circumstances. Here, the deal is done, and the buyer can buy the property based on the contract rents that are in the deal. Now,
Your premise then is that we're looking for fair market value of this property.
Yes, we're looking fair market value, and so we are looking for reality. These long-term leases exist. The rents are specified, but Walgreens wants to pretend they are not. Justice Ziegler asked, well, what if the deal had been restructured and the lease were at a lower rent? And if all other things were being the same, that would result in a lower flow of rent to the owner and so would decrease the value of the property.
Could I ask you, Mr. Hurwitz, you are here representing a number of municipalities, Stevens Point and Beloit and Brookfield and Oshkosh. Are we going to see, if you folks prevail on this side, a rush to reassess the valuation of Walgreens properties all over Wisconsin?
Yes.
The record does not say how Walgreens properties all over Wisconsin are assessed now. However, if you decide the case in favor of the city of Madison, all the other assessors in the state are going to follow the law that you decide and are going to assess Walgreens the same way. Now, the assessment, when I say the same way, I mean following the three-tier method outlined in the Adams case. First, seeing if there's a sale of the property, then seeing if there are recent sales of reasonably comparable property, and if not, and then, if necessary, going to the income approach or the cost approach. Although both sides here agreed that the cost approach was useless. Both sides here decided that the sales comparison approach was not useful. But if there were evidence of sales that were comparable, for example, if there were evidence of other sales, like the sale of 3710 East Washington Avenue all over the state, there might be enough evidence to use the sales comparison approach. Now, the fact is that 3710 sold in February 2003 for $4.4 million, $540,000 less than the assessed value, and the Walgreens appraisal.
But less or more than the assessed?
More than the appraised value, I'm sorry. Walgreens, Mr. Vitale, wants to value it at under $2 million. Well, the difference is that Walgreens wants to pretend that the leases don't exist. And the fact is that they do. Justice Prosser asked whether the value would be frozen for 20 years. Not necessarily. For one reason, even assuming that the income stream remained the same for 20 years, the value is determined in the income approach by the income divided by the capitalization rate. And the capitalization rate is a market-based figure. That alone could change. There are a number of other reasons that could change. If the property were owned by Justice Rokensack and she were on the verge of bankruptcy, then the percentage allowed for vacancy and collection loss would be greater. The assessor allowed 3%. Mr. Vitale allowed 7%. It's standard practice to allow a percentage for vacancy and collection loss.
But Horwitz, I'm not sure I understand the capitalization rate. In fact, I'm sure I don't understand it. But if the developers were paying the property taxes as opposed to Walgreens, would the capitalization rate be any different?
Only in that in the calculation of the capitalization rate, the difference would be whether or not the property tax, the answer is, short answer is no, because even if the developer were being taxed, it wouldn't make any difference. Now, in fact, here, the assessment is based on the value, the fair market value, in the hands of the developer owner. The only reason the Walgreens is here is because the lease says that Walgreens is supposed to pay the tax that would otherwise be assessed against the developer owner. Now, in the case of one of these properties, the ownership has transferred, but the lease still says that the owner, while the owner is assessed based on the value to the owner, Walgreens will pay the property taxes, whatever they are.
If the owner doesn't have to pay any property tax, isn't the value higher?
If the owner doesn't have to pay any property tax, then the expenses to the owner are lower and the value of the property would be higher, all other things being the same. But by transferring the obligation to the tenant, it changes the value of the property when offered for sale.
Like increasing the rent.
No.
The tenant pays the property tax, that's just paying more rent.
The obligation to pay the property tax is separate from the obligation to pay the rent in these leases.
It is a stream of income.
But it changes whether or not the tenant has to pay the property taxes changes the stream of income. And it's the value of the stream of income that determines the fair market value. Now,
doesn't the manual say, at least according to Flood, which I've been sitting here looking at, doesn't the manual say that the assessor is to examine the financing terms here between a buyer and a seller in trying to determine whether the sale price adequately reflects the market value of the property? Well, and if that's the case, when there's a sale, I don't really see why in this type of a situation where we're not looking at a sale, but we're really looking at valuing the real estate with everybody staying in the same place ownership-wise, why you wouldn't look at the financing terms under Flood and under what it says the manual requires.
The manual is referring to situations where value is being based on a sale of the property itself or on sales of reasonably comparable property. So the two cases here, Flood and the other case, one was about value based on an actual sale of the property. So the question was it an arm's length sale? Then you look at whether the financing terms were unusual. The second case was about whether the sale of a comparable property was an arm's length sale. So you looked at the financing terms. Here, the lease is embedded in an arm's length transaction. So the fact that there are different financing terms does not make the lease arm's length.
I don't read Flood as turning on whether it was an arm's length transaction in the usual sense of the word. They define, Flood says, well, arm's length transactions usually are cash sales where the money is gotten from a third party. Now, as you know, in Wisconsin, we do land contract sales all the time, and that's when the seller will finance at least a portion and sometimes all of the transaction. It doesn't say here if this was a land contract sale, but obviously the person that was selling this trailer park was financing the sale, and they said, well, he got a higher price for it because he included financing terms in the sale. Okay, and I guess what I'm wondering is, why do you see that as having, you said it was irrelevant, having no relationship here, where that's exactly Walgreens' argument, is that we financed our development of these properties by the payments that we made under the document called lease. But we could have had two documents, one called lease, as Justice Ziegler has suggested, and another one called financing arrangements, and still paid the same amount of money on the same property and been obligated for 20 years just the same as now.
The answer is that once Walgreens has entered into its agreements with the developer, that's a done deal. The lease has a contractual rental rates. And so if the developer who owns the property wants to sell the property, the owner is going to want to get a price that's based on those contract rents, and the buyer is going to be willing to pay a price based on those contract rents. The prospective buyer doesn't care how those contract rents got negotiated, because a dollar is a dollar to the buyer.
But you're looking at what a buyer would pay, and in Flood, they looked at the assessed value. Now, there was a sale, but they said, we won't give the assessed value what the seller actually paid. We're going to give the assessed value based on a lesser value, because what he paid included something more than the fair market value of the property. And that's exactly Walgreens' argument. So why isn't Flood something I should be thinking about?
Because Flood was about a case where a past sale of the property was being offered as the fair market value of the property, and as the only basis for the fair market value of the property. And the issue was whether that was an arm's length sale. Only if it was an arm's length sale could it be.
I disagree with you. I don't think that was the issue. I think they defined arm's length sale as one that's basically a cash transaction, and this was seller financed. And then they went on and they talked about taking into account the financing terms if that was part of the purchase price. So I guess it concerns me, because I follow the rest of your argument quite well, but I have a hard time forgetting about Flood and seeing how to deal with it.
Can you look at Flood as being X amount is paid for the property?
I'm sorry?
X amount is paid for the property. Y amount was paid for favorable terms in the loan.
Right.
X plus Y equaled the ultimate sale price.
Right.
The assessment based on the ultimate sale price of X plus Y did not represent the fair market value of the property.
Exactly.
Because X represented the fair market value of the property, Y was a purchase of a special interest term or finance term. So the sale price of that property was really X. It was folded in to be X plus Y, but you can look through that transaction and look to X. That's what you're trying to, that's what I hear you saying.
Exactly.
Okay.
And I'm saying, in contrast here, the prospective buyer of one of these properties has no interest in looking through the transaction to see how it came about, because the prospective buyer is going to buy whatever the owner has to sell. And one of the things, the main thing the owner has to sell is the lease and its actual stream of payments. Well, so it doesn't make any difference how that stream of payments was arrived at.
But why do we have to look at what a buyer would pay? This buyer in Flood paid higher than the fair market value, okay? But we didn't look at what the buyer would pay. Here you want us to look at what the buyer would pay instead of seeing if there's a separation in the monthly payments between financing and the fair market value. Now, if there's nothing in the record about this, and I think there's been some statement that there was and some statement that there wasn't, and we'll read the record, so that's not a problem. If there's nothing in the record, I can understand your argument very well, because you don't have anything else to look at. But if there is a disjointing of this payment in the record to separate out the financing, I don't understand why you look just at what the buyer would pay, where in Flood they didn't look at what the buyer would pay.
Well, here the assessor is using the income approach. Mm-hmm. And the income approach is interested in the income, the rent that the owner can transfer, the rental rights that the owner can transfer to the buyer. And that's the main thing that gives this property value.
Okay,
the
so
income approach was not being used
in
Flood or the other case.
Okay, so
and that's the difference.
That's why you say Flood's not helpful, because really they're looking at comparable sales. They're not looking income-driven valuations.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
I have a question, though.
It's a subtle point. But that's the difference.
Okay, thank you.
If you had them divide up this rental payment to, and I think this was Justice Ziegler's question, I want to make sure I understand your response. Every month you're going to get $100 from me. I'm the tenant. I'm Walgreens. Of that, $60 I mark as rent, and $40 I mark as development costs. And I'm going to get another $10 will be, I'm going to pay the taxes, so it's $110. But $100 of income every month to the landlord, right?
Yes.
Now, when the income approach is used, do we only look at that which is labeled rent, or do we look at the income stream of $100?
We look at the income stream of $100. It doesn't matter what it's labeled. A dollar is a dollar.
Right. Because whoever buys that property gets $100 a month in income.
Yes.
And we'll figure how much to buy for that property so that the return is good, whether it be a 10% return or a 6% return or whatever the return is.
Correct.
So you just look at the income stream.
Yes.
That's your position.
Yes.
Thank you.
What about the there has to have been cost of acquiring the land, in one case tearing down Midway Motor Lodge, building a new facility, either borrowing money or getting a reasonable return on money that was provided by the developer. I mean, how does that factor into all this? Does that transfer from one buyer to another?
The developer has already incurred all the development costs and has already entered into a lease with Walgreens, which provides a guaranteed rent. Say the guaranteed rent is $100. If the developer who owns the property then wants to sell the property to an investor who didn't have anything to do with developing the property, what the developer owner can get and what the investor is willing to pay will depend on the income stream, not on what it costs the developer to build the property. It might have been a good deal for the developer or a bad deal for the developer. But the deal we're talking about to value the fair market value of the property is a different deal. It's a sale from the developer owner to an investor buyer. And that sale will have a value which is increased by the value of the lease because the lease is at contract rents that are above market rents.
Are there any other questions? If not, thank you, Mr. Horowitz. Mr. Hill.
Thank you. Your Honor, I think that your hypothetical about X plus Y is very apropos. And it'll allow me to clear up a misstatement I made.
Right. Well, you're going to apply it to this situation?
The cost, pardon me?
You're going to apply it to this situation?
Apply into the situation?
Are you going to apply my...
Yes, I am,
okay,
Your Honor.
Okay, good.
The fair market value of the property standing alone, which is what assessors are supposed to do, is the X. It's the rent paid by the tenant to the landlord to occupy the premises. That's the only thing that's comparable between Walgreens and all of the other tenants of all the other retail establishments. The Y portion, in our particular case, is creative financing, the same as in Flood. Justice Rogensack, when you pointed out, Flood is right on point here, because the reason assessors and the reason the manual in Wisconsin does not allow assessors just to focus in on one factor to the exclusion of all others is that value is determined in a competitive marketplace where tenants and landlords are negotiating rents, not payback arrangements for the financing of the acquisition of a building. Consider the following. If Walgreens built its own store and was owner-occupied and it built it for $2.1 million, its assessment would be $2.1 million today. Now, how can the same building with the same owner or tenant be worth only $2.1 million? That's the X in your equation, Chief Justice. But since we decide that we're going to pay a developer back for their risk And their ability to acquire the site for us and develop it to our specifications and their bank financing, how can the value double? And the answer is it doesn't double. What happens is that we have a contract obligation that's personal to us. This court in IBM and Bischoff said that it is error for an assessor to ever concentrate on the income approach alone to the exclusion of all other approaches. In Flint, the Court of Appeals, and in Flood, this court also said that assessors need to peel back creative financing transactions to see if the financing transaction bears any relationship to what the fair market value of the property would be when compared to other properties.
Counselor, if I understand what you said to us earlier about, I think it was Exhibit 18,
yes, Your
which
Honor.
Shows that other commercial properties in the vicinity that are structurally similar are valued at probably $150+ per square foot less than Walgreens. And you said that, you know, how can that value be that different? Is there anything in the record, aside from Exhibit 18, that sets apart the contract rents in total from that part of the rent payment or the payment under the lease that is simply market rents?
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact,
you know what exhibit it is?
It's actually in Steve Vitale's appraisal, which
okay.
I believe. In fact, all we did is looked at the market rents that exist in Madison and did our income approach as appraisers and assessors are required to do based on the market rents.
Okay.
And I also wanted to point out, Justice Rogensack, that when you do examine this record, you will see that we had Mr. Tim Vergine, an MAI, that spends his life valuing the contract rights associated with the payback versus the fee simple interest, what the property would sell for. And he does that for investors for a reason. Investors are taking a risk when they buy this paper, because if Walgreens does default for any reason, then they're left with the property and they want to know what would the property sell for on the open market. So if you look at the testimony of Tim Vergine, if you look at the testimony of Stephen DeCaster, another MAI, who came in just to talk about the fact that professional appraisal practice requires that appraisers peel back the terms of what is admittedly a creative financing arrangement to see what part is X and what part is Y. The question before this court is whether or not it's ever appropriate to employ a methodology that professional appraisers could never employ if what they're asked, their assignment is what would the property itself sell for in the open market?
The thing I just have great difficulty in understanding is you are valuing this property as if it were empty, and it is not. When I use the property for my own business and then leave it, it is empty, but and it's valued at what the fair market value of that real estate would sell without my business, right? That property has a stream of income. When you buy property, whether it's a bond or real estate, you want to know what the stream of income is because that tells you what the value of the property is. And you keep coming back to this as an empty store. And that is not what a buyer of the property is looking at with Walgreens in on January 1 agreeing to pay a year's rent, let alone next year or the year after. I'm buying a stream of income. And if I buy it at $2 million and my stream of income is, what is the stream of income per year here?
In the one store?
It's yeah.
Roughly about, I believe the one is about $350,000 and the other is about $450,000 a
year. Okay, so $350,000 is my stream of income on that. then it seems to me the value is what am I willing to invest to make $350,000? And I don't care how you label it, I'm getting a $350,000 in greenbacks without labels, right? Every year. And when I don't, I'm going to go to the city and say, hey, it's not worth that anymore.
Your Honor, if I may?
Yeah, sure.
First of all, we had a sales comparison approach that did give an indication of value and that was ignored. We are not here asking that this property be valued as though it's vacant. What we are asking is that, number one, that the three-tier approach that this court has always talked about, most recently in Adams, be followed in this case, because we provided a sales comparison approach of what retail properties similar to ours sell for. But beyond that, if you're going to use the income approach to value and you're going to treat all properties similarly, all we are asking and all we've said and all we've argued is that the market rents that we would pay if the developer simply built the building themselves and said, do you want to rent it from me, that we be treated the same as everybody else. The distinction here, Your Honor, may be subtle, but it's real. The reason we're here is that we have a business model where we want a certain location and we are willing to hire a developer to build it for us. If we were a normal tenant, and Walgreens in their inline stores, we're just normal tenants, and then we negotiate our rents in a normal landlord-tenant transaction. And all we are saying is that we want the real property rights associated with our status as a tenant to be the income, the net income that's used in doing the income approach, because that's what professional appraisal practice requires and that's what the manual requires. And that they not be allowed to say, because you aren't just the tenant, because you actually drove this transaction, you told them to go tear down that motor lodge, that bowling alley, that is a contractual relationship between us and a developer. It's not at arm's length at all. They work for us. And that payback, those greenbacks, be treated for what they are, contract payments, that we're obligated to pay whether you're getting the income stream from us for the rental of the property or not. Because if what we're about at the end of the day is to compare comparable properties with comparable rents, which is what uniformity and equality, and I believe this court's case law in Flood and IBM, Bischoff require, that at the end of the day, Your Honor, that our market rents are the only baseline indicator of what's fair and equitable for our assessment. If, on the other hand, we're going to start taxing leases, then woe to the person that can't redo their lease, and woe to the landlord that's going to be stuck with the lease with no payments. That's a slippery slope that this court has never allowed. Not in the history of this court has that ever been allowed to be the rule of taxation. And I would point out to this court, and again go to Exhibit 18, when we asked for the leases for all of the other major retailers in Madison, we were told they don't exist. We didn't ask for them. So our assessment in 2003 and 2004 is based on a piece of information that we were statutorily obligated to give, but that wasn't even asked for from Target or Best Buy or Circuit City or Slumberland. And if the rule of taxation is going to be that you just go to the bottom line rents, to the exclusion of all other factors that influence value, the cost to build it, the sales of similar properties, then I submit to this court that you will have an arbitrary and capricious rule of taxation, because assessors won't have to tell anybody which ones they're looking at and which ones they're not. And that's why this court, I think, has been so clear that the methodology that should be employed has to be uniform for all, because taxation needs to be shared equally. Thank you for your time, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Hill, for your argument, and thank you, Mr. Wilmoth, and thank you, Mr. O'Brien and Mr. Horowitz, for your arguments today on another tax assessment case to come before this court. That concludes our hearing in 06 AP 1859 Walgreen Company versus City of Madison. The court is in recess until it hears its last oral argument in February later, and the court will meet in closed conference at 4:20. We are in recess. Thank you.